I'm in the commodity business. And if I want to tell somebody thank you, I write them a check. So we don't give turkeys for Christmas. Some people don't like turkey. But if they want to use some money to go buy a bunch of turkeys, they can do that too. But it's their money.
Hello, and welcome to Working with me, Dan Doriani, hosting a podcast where we explore faith, work, culture, and the way believers can make a difference in their corner of the world. My guest today is Dave Jump, an entrepreneur, the president of American Milling, and a friend of mine. Though Dave primarily works, and very successfully, to transfer grain up and down the Mississippi River and out to the world, his eye for business and his heart for his workers have made him successful. Most things he set his hand to, from the revitalization of St. Louis's beloved City Museum to the emergency production of much-needed ventilators during the COVID-19 pandemic. I am delighted to have my friend Dave Jump with me today. I think of Dave as a mover of grain. He moves grain, it's not an exaggeration to say, all over the world, but he's also a serial entrepreneur, started a number of businesses, and he's also a rescuer and repurposer of things. So if you're watching, this is just totally typical of Dave, in my opinion. He gave me this spring on the way in. And I said, well, thanks. Why are you giving me a spring? He said, well, you know, I just had a spring with me, and you could make it into a holder of pens, into a pen holder. And I thought, that is Dave Jump. Just looking at stuff and asking, how can it be even better, or put to an interesting new use? For people who live in the West, the most interesting and maybe useful, common place in which people might see that is in the City Museum, which is a bit of a misnomer. A City Museum is not exactly a museum. It's sort of a grand and glorious multi-story playground with a jet coming out in one place and a school bus hanging over the end and three-story slides that kids love and parents love to take their kids. And it was on the edge of going under financially. It was there and you repurposed it. You got it going again toward financial solvency so people in the Midwest can go there and have a good time. That's a longer introduction than I usually give to people, but I've been around Dave and his handiwork for a while. Dave, it's good to have you on the show. Which of these things would you like to accept or maybe object to or comment on first?
I'll take credit for the pencil holder.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Got to start somewhere.
Yeah, all right.
I don't know. Of the stuff that I do, most of it's not really in the public eye. The City Museum's an exception, so we can start there if you like.
Yeah, go ahead. Tell us about City Museum a little bit. It's been around for a number of years.
City Museum was started in 1997. I was not involved at that point. It was originally a not-for-profit entity with a big board of people that cared a great deal about St. Louis and downtown St. Louis especially, and about art. And Bob Cassily and his wife were the founders. Then City Museum became insolvent. It literally did fail. It didn't almost fail, it failed. And by the time it failed, I had a 50% ownership interest in the building that City Museum.
So separate from the museum. You were the landlord, you might say, or half landlord or something.
Right. The City Museum seemed important. And I was pressured by people who were reminding me how important it was. And I am a sucker for kids and for the kinds of experiences that it seemed to me that families were having there. And so, yes, I stepped in. And from a financial standpoint, I wrote the checks.
Yes.
I wrote the checks so that City Museum could pay off its debt. And then wrote some more checks so that City Museum could grow from there. I'm not the artistic person.
Right.
I'm not the visionary. I work at American Milling.
We'll get to American Milling in a second.
I work at American Milling. American Milling made sure that there was money for the paychecks and that the insurance happened and was paid for, and that the wheels didn't come off and did many of the sort of non-artistic kinds of things that needed to be done there to help it go forward. And then City Museum grew and got quite a lot bigger, multiples bigger, from the artistic work that was done there. Then the founder died in 2011. And after that, American Milling's role increased, and American Milling came to be the 100% owner of City Museum after family members were bought out as the estate got worked through.
Yeah. And then can I just break in and make sure, so people, most people hear this will never have been there.
Okay.
So it is really a fascinating place. I mean, it has things like a Ferris wheel on top of the roof.
That's
and
right.
So you can see for miles and miles. And it really does have a school bus that appears to be, you know, sort of
dangling,
careening off the edge of the roof.
Yes, it does.
And it has a fighter plane, a real fighter plane with, you know, it's stripped out, but a real fighter plane that appears to be dangled over nothingness at first glance. And of course, it's supported by all kinds of things. And it's got a lot of very strange artwork.
And it strange. Was
a, yeah. Well, it's unusual. I mean, where do you see their artwork? Come on.
Okay.
I mean, it's a unique vision. And it was on in danger of being lost to the city and the region.
Oh, it's won all kinds of awards for number one, this and that, and top 10, this and that. So I'm a big fan of creative play, especially for children. I think it's a lot of how children learn about things. Right. And I don't think there's enough creative play around anymore. But City Museum's all about creative play. There just aren't very many places where you could go and see kids from different parts of town, different parts of the country that have never met before, that are playing together and making up games.
Running around on top of each other.
Yeah, and I think creative play is a lot of where creativity comes from. It starts pretty early. And so I think that's a big deal. Another thing I think is a pretty big deal is achievement. And everybody remembers the day they learned to ride a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And they remember who was there with them. And they remember how big a deal it was. And that's achievement. That's the feeling of achievement. And it's a big deal. So if you're there with your family and the bigger ones are helping the littler ones and the moms and the dads are encouraging, and that's all pretty worthwhile, I think.
And that's just for those who haven't been able to visit the City Museum. That includes things like, you know, climbing through a winding cage to get somewhere and climbing up winding staircases.
Or
and
a thing that looks like a slinky that goes five stories high in the air.
Yes.
You got to have one of those.
Yeah, right. So that's great. But I do think this represents, I mean, it's something that's more public about what you do, but it represents to some extent who you are, because in the same general vicinity of the City Museum, that is to say, same city, same, not the same exact spot, but around.
Same part of the city.
There were a number of buildings that were, you know, had good bones, we would say, you know, lovely structures that had fallen into disuse, disrepair, junk everywhere. And you repurposed those. I mean, you know, you cleaned out the junk and buildings that were essentially useless for years are now the home of businesses and wedding receptions and
residences.
All kinds of things. So,
yeah. So I like making worthwhile things self-sustaining.
Yes.
The City Museum is like that. The buildings you're talking about are like that. I can't stay with them forever, but I like finding things not because they're broken, but because they're worthwhile and getting them to the point where they're self-sustainable because there's a next owner or they're condominiums and they're owned by the people that live there. And City Museum's the same thing. I don't own City Museum anymore, but the person that bought it, it was important to them, and it was important to them in part because of what it had become. And I think it's going to be there for a long time. So, yeah, I like doing that. I think this is what parents do. Mm-hmm. I think parents, they have babies, they have children, they're great, they grow up, and then they go on and they do their own great stuff. And that's not kind of important. That's sort of the world.
Yeah, that's good. I like it. And that's, you know, we would call that stewardship or taking care of your temporary roles in the world and then rejoicing in them, giving thanks, and then letting them go for independence. But there is another side. I'll just mention this quickly. So I've been in your office a few times, and possibly the largest chain certainly the largest chain links I've ever seen. They must weigh hundreds of pounds. I don't know what they weigh.
Each link is 700 pounds.
700 pounds. There we go. I wanted to say 750, but I didn't dare say it because nobody would believe me, but you said it. And as I recall, you know, a junkyard guy called you and said, hey, I've got these crazy chains. Nobody really even knows for sure what they ever did. Why would anybody need a 750-pound chain link? And now it's your desk. It's the foundation of your desk.
Well, that's true. It's a conference table.
Yeah.
There's maybe 12, 14 or so links there. It just sort of looks like they just dropped out of the sky and they're sort of piled up.
Yeah.
But we tipped 3 points up so that they were level, put a big piece of glass on top that was also salvaged from someplace.
Right.
And I get a lot of comments about that. And the grandkids climb around in the chain links. And so we just all have, it's supposed to be fun.
And it is fun. I mean, it draws your eye. But I do think it's part of the way God made you, what God put you on the earth to do is to find things and rescue them, repurpose them, get them ready for the next generation. I know you're uncomfortable to praise, but you can agree with me or disagree with me or just say, thanks, Dan. But I think that's what you are in measure. There's a lot more, and we'll talk about a lot more, but that is more to what you do, but that's part of it.
You've met my wife. She would tell you I'm not very good at throwing things away. So that's sort of the same thing.
So you've turned a vice into a virtue.
Yeah, part of how I make an excuse for not throwing things away is to turn some of the things I don't throw away into something
else. Useful, yeah.
Like your pencil holder there.
There you go.
Everybody's going to want one of those.
They're going to be the hottest item for
Christmas. I'm going to get a lot of phone calls.
2022. I do want to talk about your main occupation, and that's moving grain all over the world. And, I know I don't have this exactly right, but a number of years ago, maybe 5% of the world's grain came down the Mississippi through St. Louis.
Let me stop you. It's not the world.
Okay. See, I knew I had it wrong.
Of the grain that arrives in New Orleans by barge. And goes to the world, which is in the United States, this is our largest grain exporting location by far, is the port of New Orleans. Yeah. Of the grain that... I'll just finish this for you.
Yeah, finish it for me.
Of the grain that comes to New Orleans by barge 20 years ago, roughly something like 5%, more or less, from one year to the next, was coming from the St. Louis Harbor, which is more than any other place.
But
20 years later, it's right about one-third that's coming from the St. Louis Harbor. And but you were going to ask a question.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, so, I mean, that's obviously a lot of growth, and you have to be doing something right to get there. Your American milling firm is a big part of that. I'm not going to try to give it too much credit because there are lots of other barge companies, but you're one of the significant barge companies. And you have found a way to build facilities that receive and send grain on. It's just a little bit faster, a little bit cheaper, a little bit less waste. And away it goes. And then so the farmers who sell the grain want to move it through you because it's faster and they make a tiny bit more money because there's a little bit of savings and it goes around the world a little bit more readily and a little bit safer because of some things you have led. I'm not saying you do it by yourself, but you've led the way in doing some things in the St. Louis Harbor. You want to tell us about it a little bit?
Well, this goes on all the time everywhere.
Right.
You know, this is the whole culture of improvement that we're in ever since the Dark Ages.
Right.
Where everybody's, not everybody, but where you're trying to do better. You're trying to, and so if you can find a way, and I wasn't the only one. If
right.
You find a way to give the railroads what they want so that they can move bigger trains and turn them faster, there's an economic incentive from the railroads to do that.
They want to come to you because you're giving them what they want.
Right. You could cycle those trains faster, and it's more profitable for them. Same with the truckers. They're coming to get them in, get them out, fast they can go. They get an extra load a day sometimes because they can cycle faster. Barge lines. Barge lines on the Mississippi River system, there are no lock and dams from New Orleans up to the St. Louis area. Above that, meaning upstream from that, there are.
Right.
It's less efficient. So to be able to load the grain in the St. Louis Harbor, the barge lines like it. And so there's a gain for them as well. If you want to buy that grain from those farmers, you have to be prepared to bid them more than the next guy. So if you bid them an extra penny, they get an extra penny. That's on the part every, I think you're
on every
about.
Bushel or whatever.
If you don't pay that penny unless you have to, but many times, most of the time maybe, you have to use your advantage to get the grain bought. You get the volume up, the barge lines like you because you're loading lots of barges. And if you can load them fast enough and heavy enough, they can give you an incentive. And
an incentive here is not just a pat on the back, but a financial incentive.
It's a financial incentive. It's a penny here. And I mean that. It's in terms of bushels, it's a half a penny here and it's
right.
a penny there. And it's a, and then when it's
but
all
But we move
done,
a lot of bushels.
A lot of bushels. Hundreds of millions of bushels. And
right.
so when it's all over,
there's a lot of pennies.
There's a penny left for you. And that makes it all worth spending the dollars to add the rail track and to build the facilities to be able to load the barges. And
yes, to find spots where you can do this. I mean, you can't just do it anywhere you want on the
right.
Mississippi River.
Absolutely. And it's not, again, I know I've told you this, but it's
right.
not just me. I work with a group of people
right.
that each contribute toward getting this done. You know, it's common for people to think, this wouldn't have happened without me. Well, that's kind of true. You know, it wouldn't have happened without any one of
right.
half a dozen different people.
It's a team project.
That were critical.
Yeah, right. So a couple extra pennies for the farmers, a couple extra pennies for the railroads and the barge operators and the truck drivers, and a couple extra pennies saved.
I said a penny.
Yeah, okay. But half penny, quarter penny, 2 pennies, whatever,
yeah.
for the owners. And then, of course, it's also moved. I mean, it's a really efficient way to move grain around the world, too. I mean, we don't want to overdo it, but we are, you know, America's the world's breadbasket at present, at least. And we really do, we Americans, but through people like barge companies, do move grain to feed people around the world.
Absolutely. So we just get it to New Orleans, though.
Right.
We get it to New Orleans.
But you do your part. Anyway, go ahead.
There's other people doing similar sorts of things with ocean freight and with port facilities on the other side of the world that are also increasing efficiencies. But and you've pressed me on this before. I do this because I needed a job.
Yeah.
But it is correct that the collective effort of all of these people trying to be as efficient as possible, this is a little bit of that invisible hand, Adam Smith type
right.
stuff, it gets food to people more economically. That's absolutely true.
Mm-hmm. It's a result.
And I do what I can to keep as much as I can for American milling.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to be able to get the grain first.
Right, right. That's great. I appreciate that. You also get involved in some other things. I mean, you've had your hand in other businesses. I mean, moving grain is your number one. And then probably City Museum is most visible. And if somebody has a, you know, home in one of the buildings you rescued, then that counts to them. But you did also have a little bit of a hand in ramping up ventilator production in America at a crucial time in our history during the time of COVID. Do you want to say a word about that?
American Milling is the large owner in a research and development company that has developed a better ventilator. And we're producing something like 100 units a month before COVID. This ventilator is a really, really good product. And we connected with General Motors when COVID started, or they connected with us, and they did a great job. And the people, the name of this company is Ventec. The people at Ventec contributed their engineering ability, made modifications to the product.
Make it simpler, easier to make.
Yeah, because a COVID ventilator is a simpler ventilator than
right.
the one that the market they were building.
Which kind of needed to do all kinds of things, and you could focus particularly
right.
on solving COVID problems.
Exactly. So there were things that we didn't know how to do, like supply chain. Everybody knows what supply chain is now, but pre-COVID, it was not talked about every day.
So you had so supply chain because you wanted to ramp up from making 100 a month.
To over 10,000.
To over 10,000 a month. That's a very large increase. In fact, stupefying.
Sort of ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never could have done it without General Motors.
Right. Who happened to have an automotive plant.
They were shut in. They just shut down all their automotive assembly plants. So they had labor available. Labor that volunteered. They got paid, but volunteered to come to Kokomo, Indiana to start up this plant to build ventilators. And it's really special once in every 10 lifetimes or something to have an opportunity to respond to something that's so important and so needed. And I'm not the respiratory engineer, and I'm not the person that solved the supply chain issues. But once again, I was one of the people that wrote the checks.
You've got a deal-making side, I think. And, you know, you had to talk a few people into collaboration.
The company put itself at risk.
Right.
To go from 100 a month to 10,000 a month is a pretty disruptive thing.
It could have blown up.
It may yet.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to grow and spend tens of millions of dollars on a factory because you think you have sustained growth and that you're going to need to continue to need that factory. Tens of millions of dollars were spent in order to build a factory that would do this, and then it was shut down.
Mm-hmm. Because you'd made all the ventilators that were needed. By that time.
That's exactly right. And very, very fortunately.
Not a 20-year business where you're going to keep on creating these.
Well, yeah, hopefully COVID's not for the next 20 years, but also the medical community, doctors, nurses, figured out ways to treat COVID patients more and more without putting them on a ventilator. So we kind of worked ourselves out of a job, which is great.
Yeah.
We didn't expect to keep making 10,000 of these things on an ongoing basis, but it is economically... financially, a really disruptive thing to do to a tiny little company.
Disruptive to grow and disruptive also to shrink back again.
Right. You don't really get the benefit of a lot of the money that's spent to do that growth if you then just pack it up and with no expectation that you will ever need to do it again. But those ventilators, they're all over the place.
And that's why you need a GM, for example.
Oh, yeah. They're in hospitals all over the world, almost entirely United States. All over the world's not quite correct. And they get used when they're needed, and I hope they're not needed.
Mm-hmm.
But another thing that happens is there are so many ventilators out there that were produced not just by this company but by other companies as well that from a supply and demand standpoint, the post-COVID world may be awash in ventilators. That's not a great position to be in when you're in a ventilator company business.
Either. Right, right, right.
The company was put at risk. I think we're going to be okay. The company's still at risk.
And but for good cause, and that was to save some lives when COVID was rampaging.
I'm sure we did that.
Through the company, supplied our nation and, you know, helped out with the world. Even if you didn't send all over the world, at least other places could send their ventilators throughout the world. So
it was an overwhelmingly good cause.
Right.
I mean, it was just a sort of a you know, like a Halley's Comet kind of moment where there's so many times when something goes wrong, something goes terribly wrong, and you wish there was something you could do to help.
Mm-hmm. And you had a chance.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. It was an answer.
It's great to be there when somebody needs you and you can offer the hand they need.
And I'm not a doctor.
Yeah.
And I'm not a EMT, and I'm not in all sorts of things.
Yeah, but there are lots of ways to lend a hand in a time of crisis.
And I'm not a respiratory engineer.
Yeah, right.
But I was in the room, and it was pretty great.
So somehow this leads me to think of the fact that a lot of people work for you for a while.
That's true.
And so you try to give an extra penny to the farmers by creating a better model that enriches everybody a little bit. And you do share that with your workers. You know, even a place like the City Museum, you know, a place like City Museum can be a very rewarding place to work because there are all these kids and families and everybody's happy. But it can also be a difficult place to work, especially when you see your place, even if you don't know the finances, they probably could tell that this wasn't the most healthy environment when it was in the process of failing financially. So what are the guiding principles you use to treat your people well? If I were a 24-year-old, 34-year-old entrepreneur, what would you tell me about how to treat my people so that they feel loved and cared for and properly rewarded, and they stay with you for a while, which of course is good for you too, because you're not constantly retraining people.
So I think you have two questions there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really in the advice business, so we'll deal with your 34-year-old here in a moment. I think the first question was about sort of how do I think about that?
Right, yep.
Almost everybody at American Milling used to work someplace else.
Right.
And they left. And they know why they left, including me. I left.
There was something very unsatisfying.
And so when you sort of boil all those things, all those reasons together, you don't want to be a company like that. Right. You want to be a different kind of company. And
so you have a saying, or I don't know if I'm going to get it right, but you said something like, I don't want to run a company that's like the company I left. Something along those lines.
And all those people don't want to work at a company that is like the company they left. So that's, you got it just right. So you need to listen. You need to remember what was wrong where you worked, and you don't want to be like that. What that turns into for us is, yes, this is a company where a lot of people, especially people in management, know when they've made an important contribution. They know when the company has had a good year, and they know what they're worth. That's how they need to be paid. And at American Milling, we're not very big on patting people on the head. And I'm not very big on holding carrots out in front and telling them promises. I'm in the commodity business. And if I want to tell somebody thank you, I write them a check.
Okay.
Because everybody knows what that is. And I think it's genuine. And you know from our discussions in the past, I'm sort of into tangible and sort of get lost in the intangible. So we keep it, this is tangible too. We keep it tangible. And you sit down with somebody and you thank them and you tell them how important they are, but they usually know that. And you tell them, but why you think they were important. You remind them of the contribution that they made, and you do a tangible thing by economically rewarding them for that contribution. And they go home and they spend it on the things that are important to them. So we don't give turkeys for Christmas. Some people don't like turkey.
Yeah, right.
But if they want to use the money to go buy a bunch of turkeys, they can do that too. Or if they can donate to a charity, they can. But it's their money.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that we're purchasing people's loyalty. I'm not saying we're not. It's about participating. These people are not literally partners, but they're supposed to share in the achievement, just like the kid riding the bicycle, just like the family at City Museum. It's the achievement really
it's corporate,
matters.
Right.
And so, so it's a great way, it's a good way to help people feel that they were part of achievement, to remind them of what got done that year and how important they were to it.
So
that's
achievement. Yeah. So, you said, you don't say many words. But actually, you do say words, but you link it to action. So there's a theory in theology or Christian formation that the way we're formed is by linking words and practices. So practices alone don't change us, nor do words alone change us. It's words and practices. So you label things, and then you do things that are coherent with what you label. So I think what you're doing is actually an instance of that. So you tell people, it's been a good year and you played a significant role. You did this. You did this. And here's a practice that backs up the words. You played a significant role. We were profitable. You are going to share in the profits now. Does that make sense to you?
And thank you.
Yeah, and thank you. Right. So we take words and deeds and we put them together. So you have a certain philosophy, and I'm going to just hit a couple of these. That one of them is, we're in the business of doing things. That's one of your statements. That is to say, we didn't come to watch. This is supposed to be demanding. That's why we call it work. You expect work to be demanding.
Right. Yeah. If it was play, we'd call it play. But if it's,
right.
I'm going to go to work today.
Right.
And that's. Again, that sort of, I'm beating this to death, but that goes back to the achievement. I mean, accomplishing things takes work, sometimes hard work. So I grew up in agriculture, but this isn't unique about agriculture. When things have got to get done, they've got to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's work.
Yeah.
And it's not that way all the time, but that's work. And I think it's that way for farmers. I think it's that way for firemen.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's that way for truck drivers with supply chain stuff. It's that way for doctors and nurses with COVID.
Believe it or not, it's that way for writers. They say, this has to be in by July 24th. And you got to get it in by July 24th. You really do.
So things things need to be done, and they get done with work. And it's good to feel good about work. And I know work's one of your things. And you know, I think there's such a thing as a workaholic.
Yes.
I don't think you want to be any of those holics, right. You know, maybe shopaholic or something. But I mean, you know, most of the holics are bad. So I think there are such things as a workaholic. But when the fireman shows up and it's your house on fire, you're not concerned whether or not he's a workaholic.
Right. You want to know if he can pull the hose out and get the water going.
You need him to get some work done.
And, well, you need accomplishment. That, you know, you and I have talked about the need to accomplish things.
And after you
accomplish it, it's good to recognize it and to reward it and to declare it. But in the meantime, you got to actually do it.
And COVID's going to be behind us at some point. And I hope that there may be doctors, nurses, all sorts of people involved in the medical community that feel burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
But I hope they also feel a great sense of achievement and that the work that they did was worthwhile and it was important because it is.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's not like work's the only thing that makes the world go round, but I don't know. It doesn't work without work.
Toil.
And there's a time for play. And I've already talked about creative play. Creative play is really, really important. When it's time to work, it's time to work.
Yeah.
And yeah, it can be demanding. It's demanding for the person that's putting out the forest fire. And, you know, you ask a child, you know, what do you want to do when you grow up? I don't know if children are still asked that or not, but what do you want to do when you grow up? What they describe is usually work.
Interesting work.
Yeah, they want to do something that they care about and something that's important to them. But it's usually work. I mean, they don't often say. I mean, they might even say, "I want to be a professional baseball player." But that's work.
But that's work too.
That's work.
Right.
And they might want to say. They might say, "Well, gosh, I just want to lay around on the beach all the time."
And they don't say that.
Maybe they do.
I've never heard a child say that. They do actually. They say, "I want to be a fireman or doctor or baseball player."
We'll find
or whatever.
One. We'll find one.
Well, I'm sure there's a child somewhere, and maybe they learned it from somebody.
But anyway, so it's, yeah, works, it's important. And it's important to get good at something, I think. It's important to do it well, and it's important to feel good about the work that you do. You spend a lot of your time working.
This podcast is a production of the Center of Faith and Work in partnership with the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. If you're enjoying this conversation, you know the drill. Please rate this podcast and subscribe to it. And visit our workingwithdan.org site to get updates on new episodes, explore old episodes, hear clips from lectures on work, and enter to win our giveaways. As we jump back into this conversation with Dave, I wonder if you too have ever struggled to discern the difference between working hard and workaholism. When does good, diligent, faithful stewardship of the resources and position God has given us turn into idolatry? What sorts of checks and accountability do you have in your work to guard against both sloth and overwork? So let me hit a couple of themes that we have discussed in other occasions. One is that it's good to work and good to work hard and get things done, but the quest for perfection can be the foe of getting things done. It's not usually best, wise, well-advised to try to aim for perfection. What you want to do is get things better than they were.
Okay. So I think about that in a couple ways. First of all, perfection is in anything, not just work, is sort of a futile goal.
Endlessly elusive.
Right. There's a sort of literally no such thing.
Not in this world.
So there's that element to it. But there's an economic element to it also that's about sort of the marginal utility of trying to make things perfect. So in this example,
a tolerance of 1/1000th of an inch to 1/10000th, it may cost a great deal more to get your tolerance down to that extra level of closer to perfection.
I'll give you a different
scenario.
So imagine there's 5 opportunities worth pursuing, 5 business opportunities. See, I'm a business guy that we're having that conversation.
Yep.
5 business opportunities worth pursuing. And each one of them is worth $100. Okay. And they take time and they take resources, they take investment, they take people. And if what we do is you and I, we go after, and other people, we go after 2 of them and we get them 90% right and they're each worth $100, that's 90 plus 90. But if we instead go after all 5, and spread ourselves a little thinner and get them 60, 70% done. Well, hey, the 70% of five of those $100 opportunities, I think, is $350.
Yeah.
So we're doing better. And there are other people maybe who have other skills that can take them the last step, or may even look at it and say, oh, you missed it. This is not a $100 opportunity. This is a $200 opportunity. And I'm going to take it and make it better because I've got different skills. So to just refine forever, well, not forever, but to go for that last 10% is many times just not worth it, especially if there's three other things that you can go after and get them to 50, 60 in pretty short order.
But you also like to go after things that other people aren't doing.
Well.
And I mean, maybe everybody does. I mean, I'm a seminary professor, and a, you know, seminary should probably try to not be good at everything, but to ask, what are we equipped to do? What does the world need of seminaries, and what can we do better than anybody else? Because you don't want to make everything you provide into a commodity, right? If you can find something nobody else is doing, there's no competition, would be one way to say it.
That's exactly right. So in the businesses, most of the businesses I'm in, there are big guys, big guys, Fortune 500, Fortune 100.
Billions companies. And billions and billions.
And I don't want to compete against those guys.
Right.
They got all the great toys in all the right spots, and they've got money to do.
You want to find what they're neglecting.
Well,
or
the way to make something better, or the way that maybe it's the things that they choose to not pursue to perfection, that there's a remaining 20% to do. And that's something that we've got sufficient resources to go after. So, yeah, I'm not sure exactly where you thought I was going to go with your question. But yes, I do think if you try to do what everybody else is doing, it's much harder to distinguish yourself. If you, especially with limited resources in a small to mid-sized business, you need to be a little more creative. You need to keep your eyes open a little wider. You need to remember what you saw last year and the year before and how to assemble some puzzle pieces that came from different places to put together something that's economically useful. And then you go with it.
I remember one time we had a conversation, and I'm going to have this way off. I wasn't planning on talking about this. But there was a problem you were aware of something like storage of plastic balls or ball bearings or something. We had this conversation several years ago. And, you know, there was no place to store this. And you were just driving around one day, and a solution to the problem occurred to you.
Let me rescue you before you get in any deeper. That specific thing I think you're talking about is plastics are everywhere. They're in the Coke bottle. They're in the
right.
So, but they get produced in pellets.
Right, pellets. Right,
pellets.
Not ball bearings.
And those pellets comes in different grades.
But they are round, right?
They're like a cigarette butt.
Okay.
They're in different grades, different colors, different sizes, and they're produced at a finite number of origins.
Okay.
But they ship to thousands and thousands of destinations that need this type, this size, this
right.
color, whatever. But you don't make them at these gigantic facilities you need five of these? Sure. Yeah, we'll get right on it.
You know, thousands and thousands of them.
It's not like curbside pickup or something
that.
So the opportunity there was there's things railroads don't really like to do. Railroads like moving big volumes in big trains and cycling their trains as quickly as possible. And they don't really like messing with the two cars here, five cars there, six cars there.
With little pieces of plastic that are size of a cigarette
butt. And there's somebody out there, I don't know where the camera is, somebody out there working at a railroad is going to call me on this. But effectively, I think I'm right about this.
Okay.
And so,
they may disagree, but you have the microphone. So
railroads are a good example of, the Class 1 railroads are a good example of mega companies that focus on the things they want to do, that they're good at, and there are other things, functions that still need to be done. And so if you're, I can't compete with the Union Pacific Railroad, I don't want to compete with the Union Pacific Railroad. But if there are things that I can do that multiple railroads need done that are useful to their customers or useful to them, yeah, that's the kind of fill the crack on the wall sort of thing that is an opportunity that if you're a good listener and you can start to assemble pieces from different industries, that there's opportunity. So we built some railroad track in the East St. Louis area, well, it's literally in the East St. Louis, to accommodate this surge, this called storage and transit. And we'd like to build lots more of that. And I think maybe that was something talking about.
But you and I agree that what you have to do, if you can listen and remember, somebody said there's a need over here, and then if it's just in the back of your mind somewhere, and you haven't forgotten it, you haven't neglected it, you let it register, then you might see the solution to this need or problem they have months or even years later.
Oh, somebody might say, you know, there's all these railroad yards and they were stripped for scrap for the rails years ago and it's still sitting there and we'd like to, you know, there ought to be something we can do with
that. And then that links with
something
else.
And then you go back and call those other people and you say, are you still looking for that? And
right, exactly.
And then you check on what the rates are and then you do what we were talking about before. You do things.
Mm-hmm.
You don't continue to think about it and study it forever.
You
do it.
You actually get the plastic stuff moved. So, I mean, I enjoy doing that with, I don't work with objects. I don't move things around, but I remember somebody says, you know, I like my job, but it's very, very frustrating in a certain way. I don't get to use a certain skill set at all. I'd love to use it again. And you just stick it in the back of your mind. And 2 years later, you're having a conversation with somebody who says, we need somebody who can X, we can't find him. And I go, well, I talked to George 2 years ago.
That's it.
And he said he was really eager to start using this skill set again. And so I called George up and I said, George, are you still at that place that won't let you use your skills? Yep. Still frustrated? Yep. Hey, I've got an opportunity for you over here. Are you interested?
Right, we need you.
Yeah, right. So another aspect of your approach to work is that you want to operate ethically according to the rules, but you also know the rules change. And one of your approaches is you got to know the rules, play by the rules, but also use the rules to your advantage. Explain what you mean when you say that sort of thing. And again, we'll say, let's just imagine a hypothetical, I don't know, an energetic young man or woman who also— This is our 34-year-old. Maybe they need a little bit of a moral compass. Maybe they're in danger of just doing whatever it takes. You go, no, don't do whatever it takes. You got to follow the rules. You got to know the rules, but also use the rules. And don't get too enamored with the rules because they may change in 6 months.
I consider myself very fortunate that in my career, especially sort of the first half of my career, that I was in the grain business.
Mm-hmm.
The grain business is a very ethical business populated by fiercely honest people. And you are not welcome in that business if you are not regarded as honest. I think that's a good thing
for
anybody.
It's good for me.
There's a great environment, and it's great to know that people can function very, very well without shaving the edges of truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not true of all industries. Some industries, it's quite the opposite. And if you're not a good liar, you got trouble.
Mm-hmm. So we won't name any industries, but we're probably both thinking of some.
And I would encourage that 34-year-old to steer clear of those.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
but so.
And let's just, can I label it? And if you find yourself in an industry like that, where you're pressed to lie or deceive, it's really a good time to get a new job and switch industries.
I wouldn't know.
Well,
I'm going to trust you on that.
Morally and ethically, as a disciple, you know, you don't want to have a constant pressure to lie or else be fired or disapproved of. I mean,
I certainly could say that if someone came to me and they said, "Hey, I'm not sure what I want to do with my career. Maybe I'm graduating from college this year or something like that." I absolutely would not steer them toward a business of scoundrels and thieves.
Right.
I would intentionally steer them toward a business of opportunity and of growth, and one where the ethical standards were pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
But your question is about playing by the rules and how do you do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't like sports analogies, but I'm going to use one. Yeah. You know, so I like the tangible stuff. I know you know that, and I've said it a couple times. I like rules-based environments, too, where I can learn the rules. So pick a game, you know, the game of football. Well, there's all kinds of lots and lots of rules. There's a rule for everything. But yet there's a lot of room for creativity. You see these trick plays and you see ways of scoring points that you haven't seen before. And people are well thought of for not underinflating the football, perhaps, because you might break that breaking a rule. But I mean, coming up with a more creative way to devise different plays and things of this sort. And the I think that's sort of what I'm talking about. Figuring out, you know, we were talking several minutes ago about ways to do things more efficiently. Well, that's some of it. When you're shipping grain from the St. Louis Harbor, you're figuring out ways to play by the rules, to pay people what they're supposed to be paid, but yet take what's existing and figure out better ways to do it. Again, all within the rules. The environment keeps changing. And yes, sometimes the rules keep changing. But as long as the rules are changing for good reasons.
Well, because culture is always changing. Business is changing.
Yeah, but you can't get out ahead of the rules too much. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if the speed limit's 65 miles an hour, but it's supposed to go to 75 next week, you got to wait till next week.
Right. That's good. That's good. Let's go to lightning round, shall we?
Oh, boy.
You ready?
Pressure's on.
All right. So for these, I won't set off a gong, but we're given short answers.
Short answers.
Short answers. So I'll let you answer this one of two ways. What book changed your life? Or, same question, different version, similar question. What book do you like to give away to people who are interested in living well?
Easy.
Okay.
I never recommend books.
Okay.
The only books I read are nonfiction.
Yeah.
Normally engineering history. And okay. You don't recommend that.
You have no recommendation.
No, don't recommend that.
All right. If you have 2 free hours, what do?
I find out if my grandchildren are available.
Okay.
And if they're not, I call my friend and go for a bike ride. If he's not available, I might go by myself.
Okay, good. That answers another question. How do you stay in shape? I'm going to say physically, you just answered it's riding a bike, but how do you also stay in shape emotionally and spiritually?
Well, I'm not sure I stay in all that great a shape on the bicycle physically. Emotionally and spiritually, I go on walks with you.
Okay.
Okay. And emotionally, I just don't really think about it much.
Okay.
I mean, like if you'd ask me, are you having a good day? I'd have to think about it. I don't go through the day thinking about this.
You're doing what lies in front of you. You're working. It's a workplace. You're trying to make better.
Yep. Or I'm just doing something. I'm with my grandkids, or I'm with my wife, or I'm doing one thing or another. Yep. If I'm having a bad day, I need to change it. So that's on me.
Okay. Putting aside all practical considerations, what would you do if you could do anything for 1 year? What would you do?
I would be the dictator of a small country.
Why do you choose that?
Well, I mean, you know, I'd be a dictator because...
You would be a benevolent dictator.
Oh, yeah, a really good one. Really, really good dictator because as a dictator, I don't have to mess around with Congress or the courts or any of that. Right. I could just be a dictator.
Maybe a city state, so it's all one entity, kind of like Singapore or Liechtenstein, you know, really small so you can check out everything
if they're looking,
boundaries.
They ought to get a hold of
you're
me.
Willing.
But you say why a dictator, why a small country? Small country, I don't think I'm qualified for a large country to be the dictator. I would want to start small, work my way up.
Oh, if you had a second year, you might take a bigger country. All right. I'm going to ask you a very different question. Have you reexamined any of your convictions lately?
I think you should be cautious about having too many convictions.
Okay. All right.
I would like to be useful.
Okay.
That's a conviction. Okay. I would like to be useful, and I don't want to wind up with enough convictions that I'm, you know, sitting on a park bench with two friends that share my convictions. We have all the answers, and nobody's interested in what we have to say. So I think I don't have that many convictions. I know the things that I care about and what are important to me. I don't expect to be remembered by more than a handful of people for a short period of time. So that's about it.
Mm. Hey, I like your realism. I'm just going to mention one other thing we've said and then say thank you and we'll be done. But I love your view that sometimes the bad guys win. Sometimes lying and cheating do pay off. That's not our problem. Our job is to do what lies in front of us. Now I'm talking, those aren't your words. These are now my words. It's our job to lie, to take care of what is in front of us and let God take care of the liars and cheaters and try to love our neighbor and be a good guy in our work.
I bring up the subject of liars and cheaters because sometimes they do get ahead.
They do.
And that's contrary to what I was told growing up.
Right.
You know, do a good job.
Cheaters never win.
The cheaters never win.
They never prosper. But sometimes they
do. But they do. Sometimes they do. So the world has not collapsed.
Right.
If that happens,
yep.
You need to stick to what matters. And you're right. Their day may come. You may not see it. They may go on to live wonderful lives and make lots of money, but that's not my department.
Well, I mean, the Psalms certainly say many times that God calls us to account and justice is imperfect in this life. And of course, we don't call for perfect justice, right? We do call for mercy because we need mercy ourselves.
I'm just saying to the 34-year-old.
Yeah, right. Oh, good.
This
yeah.
one, when you see it,
yeah.
it doesn't mean all the things, the world's come apart. It happens. And if somebody is successful that way, you don't want to do that.
Hey, it's been good to be with you, Dave. Thanks for stopping by and sharing your wisdom from your life and business. Good to have you as our guest.
Well, it wasn't too painful.
Thanks again to today's guest, my good friend, Dave Jump. One thing I love about Dave is the way he quietly and faithfully uses his position of power or authority and influence, along with his creative flair and love of the good things God has made to improve his corner of the world. If you are curious about what it would look like for you in your work to change your corner of the world, check out this show's episode notes or visit workingwithdan.org to get a free copy of a worksheet. It has questions to help you discern how God might call you to improve your corner of the world for the glory of God and for the good of your neighbor. At our website, you can explore archives of old episodes, subscribe to receive updates on new episodes, receive giveaways, and find bonus content. This podcast is a production of the Center for Faith and Work in partnership with the Alliance for Confessing Evangelicals. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And one more time, I'm Dan Doriani, reminding you to work hard, make a difference, and from time to time, take a break.